And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Ann R. from San Carlos.
Okay. Hi, my name is Ann, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi.
Hi. Oh, I'm nervous. I wanted to just read a couple of notes because I wanted to be sure I covered a couple things. Thanks to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 Steps, I have been sober for 8 years. My sobriety date is November 2nd, 2002, so I just celebrated a birthday. And my home group is the Women's Let Go, and my God, so ladies, come on down on Monday nights. If you are new tonight, welcome. This program saved my life, and I hope that if you keep coming back, you'll feel comfortable and get the program, and it'll save your life, too. Okay, so now I can just go off the cuff. I didn't know that I was going to be the main speaker tonight, so... When John asked me a couple of weeks ago, I was like, 10 minutes? Oh, sure, no problem. And then this afternoon, I found out I was the main speaker. And this is how God works in my life. I didn't have time to worry about it. Of course, I called my sponsor right away. I'm like, hey! What the heck? She didn't answer the phone. I left her a message, and then I called another woman in the program and said, hey, what the heck? And we joked around for a few minutes. She gave me really good advice. She said, in all seriousness, why don't you pray about it and ask God to direct your thoughts and your words. So there you go. I know. Would have been probably the last thing I would have thought. Well, it was the last thing I thought about because I sat at the computer for a couple hours writing stuff down. Just a whack job. So I'll tell you a little bit about my story. I believe I was born an alcoholic. I come from a long line of alcoholics, really long line of alcoholics. In fact, my family tree is, on both sides of my family, has been traced back really, really far. And generations back, my maternal grandfather, when they came to America, actually were kind of bigwigs and landowners and all this stuff. And the one that came over here, it was like 1628, had all this prestige and stuff and had 10 sons. And as I was reading recently through this family history, I asked my mom, I'm like, well, you know, they were wealthy landowners. Where's all the money? Where's mine? You know? It's like 400. They did. They drank it up. And that's... And, you know, so it's a long line of alcoholics in my family. It's so ridiculous. But I was raised by two fairly normal parents. They're not heavy drinkers, you know. They drink normally, not like an abused child or any of that. But like a lot of us, I started drinking in high school. I don't know, peer pressure or whatever, something to do. I don't know, you know. And, you know, I would drink with my friends and... It was really weird because they all seemed to be able to catch a buzz and, like, stop and not wind up doing stupid stuff. And I seemed to be the one who would always get drunk and always have a hangover. And I just couldn't have just one. And, I didn't realize that that was a problem. I mean, I didn't even notice that my friends were not getting as drunk as I was. Pretty self-centered, so, you know. But apparently, other people around me knew. And, in fact, in my senior yearbook, somebody wrote, Ann, three beers is too much. And, you know, everybody else knew before I knew. I didn't know. I look back on that now, and I think, gosh, you know, how fortunate I would have been if that signature in that yearbook would have snapped me to attention, and you know, wow, who knows? Well, I don't know what would have happened, but that's not, you know, I didn't get sober at that time. I spent a good deal of my college years and early post-college years completely wasted, out of my mind. Don't know how I graduated college. I think I BS'd my way through it with a lot of the professors. I really have no idea. I was a communications major, and I was a DJ in college. That was part of the deal. You had to be a DJ. You had to be working the radio station. And I remember I came in for my shift drunk one night, and my professor, who was a big shot. This was up east of L.A. This guy was a big shot on L.A. radio. You know, ripped me off the air and had to do my shift for me. And he doesn't work for free, you know. And I remember he lit into me and he's like, you don't ever, ever show up drunk on the air. I didn't get it. I was like, whatever, dude. whatever. I couldn't believe it because he was a big partier too, but whatever, you know. So I don't really know how I got through college. And I spent a great deal of my early, after, you know, post-college years, just doing stupid stuff like we all do. And I kind of knew that I had a problem. I kind of was starting to glean that I had a problem. You know, I got a DUI right before I turned 21. And I had drugs in the car and, you know, spent the weekend in jail, whatever. And I got sentenced to through a diversion program. Excuse me. And I got sentenced to a drug education program and a couple of months of AA meetings. And I went because I'm kind of a rule follower, oddly. Tell me what to do and I'll do it, mostly. But at the time I would do it, but I wouldn't do it sober. So I went into this drug education program. I went to the AA meetings and I got my little court slip signed, but I didn't get the program at all. I didn't get it. Kept on like that. At 26, I got arrested for crack possession and, was drinking and doing all that nonsense. And I got sentenced to another drug education program. I guess I thought I didn't know enough. I don't know. And again, the AA meetings, I didn't get it. I guess that was not the plan that God had for me. I don't know. But I didn't get it. And just kind of went on my merry way. And I started to do those things. I started to realize I had a problem. And I started to do those things that we do. Like we talked about earlier on in the meeting, those things that we do. You know, I switched from whiskey to rum to wine. I didn't drink during work hours. I just all that stuff. I moved from L.A. back to San Diego, up to L.A. back down. You know, all that stuff that we do, and I had all these little rules for myself. And I promised myself that I would get sober when I got married. And then I would get sober after my honeymoon. Because I can get sober when I got married. And then I would get sober on my first anniversary. and it just wasn't working. Nothing. I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't. I don't know. And I remember one night I was just in tears. Because I wanted to be sober. Well, I wanted to not be in pain. I wanted to not be this person who was compelled to stop at the liquor store every single night. I couldn't drive past my little liquor store. I didn't want to be that person. And I remember one night I was crying and crying to my husband. And I was like, I don't know what to do. I need help. I need you to help me. And, you know, my husband has known me since I was 17. And he looked at me and he said, I can't help you. And I don't know if it was, you know, where that came from, but I think it's one of the smartest things he ever said to me. You know, it was certainly one of the wisest. I truly believe that God directed him that night because he must have felt so helpless. And to be able to say that, you know, I'm sure was very difficult for him. But he couldn't help me. And it was shortly after that that I went to go see a counselor. It was interesting kind of turn of events because, and I will out my brother at this point. He, with his permission, he's in recovery. And at the time, he was very, very ill from alcoholism himself. He was very close to death. And my family was preparing to do an intervention on him. And they didn't realize the extent of my drinking. For some reason, I guess I was sort of a functioning sort of alcoholic. You know, I had all the surface stuff. I had the job and the car and the husband and the whatever. So kind of looked okay on the outside. But they were getting ready to do this intervention, and they hadn't invited me. And I was pissed. I was like, well, you know, it was so egotistical, but I was pissed. I was like, why am I not included? And I think they were trying to protect my relationship with my brother for whatever reason, in case it went badly. I don't know. But I was pissed about it, and I went to go see a counselor. And the counselor was like, well, clearly you have a problem with alcohol, and that's probably why they're not inviting you, you know. So I went into treatment. I went into outpatient rehab. And I'm very competitive, and if my brother was going to be sober, damn it, I was going to be sober too. You know, and I was going to show him how to do it right. God, and it's just, I'm a sick ticket. And so we got sober, and he actually wound up getting sober a couple of months before me. It took me a while to figure it out, but. So I went into this outpatient rehab, and I was going to be the best recovering alcoholic you ever saw. I was just, you know, I did every single thing they told me to do. Again, I'm a rule follower. And so I did 90 and 90. I did more than that, but I did 90 and 90. I did I got a sponsor right away. I started working the steps right away. I did two meetings every single morning. I would go to a 6 a.m. and a 7 a.m., and then I would go to work, and I was happy, joyous, and free. And, worked the 12 steps. In the first year of sobriety, I had worked the 12 steps. I had quit smoking, and I was pregnant. And we were planning on buying a new house, and it was all... had a great job. It was all good. And everything was great. And I stayed sober for a little while. And, I got sober and I lived in Lemon Grove. And so I spent a lot of time at the Lemon Grove Alano Club. And I would go to that. There's a biker meeting there on Sunday mornings. Love that meeting. There's a lot of sobriety. But they had a big 6 a.m., a good 6 a.m. and 7 a.m. meeting there. I don't know if they still do. But that was still there. That was my deal. That was how I would start my day every single day. And it was good, but I never really got into the fellowship of the program. I didn't make a lot of friends. I didn't do any women's meetings. I just only did those mixed meetings. And I didn't do a lot of real socializing with alcoholics. And I think that was missing for me in my program. So after a couple of years, we decided to move up here to San Carlos. And I had grown up in San Carlos, and I did not want to go to meetings because I might run into somebody I knew. I obviously there was some kind of problem with my program. Because my sobriety was a big secret to me. I was anonymous at work, and I was anonymous just about everywhere. Very few people knew that I was in recovery. Close friends, my parents, and just very few people. It was a big secret to me, even though I had worked with a sponsor through the 12 steps. I had still all this shame. And I mean, I thought I had worked a pretty good 12-step program that first time around. And it was pretty thorough. And I did, I had financial amends to make. And I went and, told people, went to previous employers and said, I stole from you, and here's your, you know, brought cash in case they figured I was writing them a bad check because I had stolen from them. So I stole from you, and here's the money back. But for some reason, there was a lot of guilt and shame still, and so I stopped going to meetings. And I do not recommend that in any way, shape, or form. I think, started me on this road to losing touch with the program. I stopped going to meetings, and I didn't go to take a four-year token. You know, even if I wasn't going to meetings in my neighborhood, there's no reason why I couldn't go back to my home group and take a token. And then I felt bad because I hadn't gone and taken a token. And then I had all of, you know, it was all excuses started coming. I have all these excuses. Why should I stay sober if I, you know, I didn't take a token. I didn't go to the meetings. I used to be an alcoholic. I remember I was working with Amy. We had a conversation one day, and I told Amy, I used to be an alcoholic. Yeah. So I'm a special event planner for a living. That's what I do for a living. That's what I've been doing for a long time. And you know, you're put in situations where there's alcohol a lot. And I wine and dine clients. And the place where we worked was every Friday afternoon. It was wine time, and we'd have happy hour, and it's just not the greatest environment for, you know, a not so deep into her program alcoholic to be working. So anyway, I was working on a large meeting that was going to be happening in Las Vegas, and I went to this meeting, and 10 days in Las Vegas, probably not a great idea. And I called home that first night and talked to my little boy. He was 3 and a half. And I didn't know how much I was going to miss him. And so I felt so bad. I felt horrible, you know. And I'm like, okay, good night, baby. You know, and then my husband got on the phone and I said, I am not going to call home for 10 more days until I am on the airplane on my way home because I can't take hearing his little voice, you know. And just I felt so lonely and so guilty for being away from him. And he's like, okay, well, that's fine. You know, have a good convention. And I, you know, and he had no reason to think that I was going to do anything crazy. And I hung up the phone and called room service and ordered up a bottle of wine, you know. And I drank a couple glasses of wine and got up the next morning, went, you know, did my meeting and all of that. And I was trying so hard to be so good. And I'm like, oh, I'll keep it under wraps. Nobody will know. And you know, and the final night gala, oh, it was bad. It was bad. It was, you know, we had this big event. It was 600 people at the MGM Grand, and it was a big gala dinner and all of this stuff. And you know, it was going off great. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to have a glass of wine. And it was, I believe, about 3 o'clock in the morning by the time I started rolling myself into my hotel room. And I had to call down to the front desk and ask for a late checkout and call the airline and change my flight because I was supposed to leave at 8 o'clock in the morning. There was no way I was getting on that plane to come home. I was too drunk. And I thought, maybe if I could sleep this off. And so I took the plane home at 9 o'clock that night, and I was still drunk. Hadn't drank all day. Tried to sleep it off all day. I was still drunk when I got off that plane. It was a mess. I don't know how my husband didn't know, but how close am I? But he didn't, and I didn't tell him, and I didn't drink again for a while, a couple weeks, long time. couple weeks. And then we were out to dinner one night with his brother. It was his brother's birthday. We were out to dinner, and I ordered a glass of wine, and my husband looks at me, and I was like, oh, you know, it's okay. You know, I didn't mention it, but I had a glass of wine while I was in Las Vegas, and it seemed fine. Didn't seem to create any problems, so I think I'm okay. I can drink now. And he's like, okay, you know. He's a normie, so what does he know? And he just, you know, and he loves me and he believes me and whatever. So, and this is how, you know, I'm a little conniving, manipulative alcoholic. And I looked at him and I said, but if you see that it's starting to become a problem, you just let me know. I'm going to make him responsible for my sobriety, you know. And I'm sure if he would have just let me know, I would have been like, oh, all right, let me just go to rehab. he didn't say a word. He didn't say a word. And it did not take long before, you know, it wasn't just wine in the house every now and then. It was a big old bottle of rum in the house every night. It didn't take long before I was really depressed and really not very nice, and, you know, at the office, watch until it was 5 o'clock until I could stop at the liquor store and get my bottle. It did not take long before I started up with the little rules again. The new set, I had a new set of rules, and I was a rum drinker, and if there was a half an inch of rum in the bottle when I went to bed, then I was okay. I was all right. I wasn't an alcoholic. And if I woke up in the middle of the night with a panic attack or whatever, I could have a drink. And as long as I quit drinking before the sun came up, I was still good because it was still nighttime. So I loved it when the sun would start rising later on in the morning. That was awesome. And, you know, so those were like my rules. And it was just, it was bad, and I was so depressed and so sad and so suicidal. I don't know what my son thought. Ooh, you know what I just thought of? I had this glass that I would drink out of, always the same glass, like my own sippy cup. And and I would tell my son, don't drink mama's drink. And I just thought about this. When I got sober again, for the longest time, if I would leave the room, he would sip out of my drink. And somebody told me, I think it was Tara told me, he's checking to see if there's alcohol in there. He doesn't do that anymore. I just remember that. So anyway, it didn't take long. But I was out when I left the program and when I relapsed. It took me 5.5 years to get back. So it wasn't long before all that bad stuff started happening, but it was a long darn time before I was able to get help and get back in the program. And when I did finally get help, I had to be hospitalized. I was completely suicidal. I had to go in on a suicide watch. My shrink had told me, well, we're gonna get you into this place, and they're gonna, you know, because I finally said, listen, I gotta get some help, and he said, we're gonna get you medically detoxed. And I was like, okay, cool. So I said, so how does it work? And he's like, well, you go down there and you have an interview, and then they'll tell you, you know, whether or not they have a bed for you. And I said, so then can I go home and pack? And he's like, oh yeah, sure. This is not what happened. And I went down there, and they had me locked down before, you know, I didn't know what the heck was going on. And the next thing I know, they're like, well, tell your husband what you want to bring and want him to bring you. And I'm all, well, bring me my sweats. And they look at him, and they're like, you know, no tie sweats. And I'm like, bring me my sneakers, no shoelaces. Bring me my cigarettes, no lighters. God, I was just like, my head was spinning. I had no idea. And then that first night in there, and I don't know what they gave me, whatever, you know, Valium or whatever, and I was sleeping all good. They kept coming in and waking me up and taking, like, my heart rate and my blood pressure and all that stuff, and I was getting really pissy, and I'm like, why are you bothering me? You know, like, I am in here to rest, recuperate, recover. Don't you know who I am? And the nurse told me, she's like, do you realize you could go into cardiac arrest or you could have a seizure, you could stop breathing at any moment? And I didn't know. Okay, I didn't know that. So anyway, I got detoxed. And when I got out of the hospital, yeah, I was going to come here tonight and I was going to tell you that when I got out of the hospital, the first thing I did was go to a meeting, but I didn't. I went to a movie. And then I came to a meeting, and I walked in the room, and Barbara was there, and Sheila was there, and they welcomed me. I got a hug, and I got greeted at the door, and I know you guys do that here tonight, and I cannot tell you how much it meant to me at that time, and it still means to me when you have greeters at the door, and I so appreciate that. And I felt welcomed, and I listened. And I heard Tara share that night. And whatever it was she said, I couldn't tell you today, but I wanted what she had, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And I'm very fortunate that she's still my sponsor today. And we've had that relationship for a long time. And we've worked the 12 steps and been through the ups and downs of life. And you know, I'm so blessed to have her as my sponsor because, I already was married and had a child, and I got to watch Tara go through that, you know, finding the one that would be her husband and watching her go through having a child. And so it's been a real symbiotic relationship. And I have women in my meeting who have teenagers older than mine, thank God, and I've got their experience, strength, and hope to go on because that's a whole nother road. And I'm so grateful for the women in my program who are teaching me how to raise, you know, a teenager. So that first meeting I went to felt really welcomed, and I knew I was home again. And I knew the deal. I knew how to, you know, I had been through this once before, so I knew. I knew what I needed to do was get a sponsor, and I knew what I needed to do was work the 12 steps, and I knew I needed to get consistent in my meetings. And thank God, you know, I've been able to do all that, and it's been a great journey. And what I have this time in my sobriety that I really think I didn't have, and I know it's a controversial issue, is I am not at all anonymous in my outside life. It's a personal decision by all means. For me, it's a little bit of a safety issue because I am still in the hospitality industry. I need to be able to say, you know, it's okay for me to go out and wine and dine my clients and to, if they say, oh, won't you have some? No, thanks. And now I can say it and I don't need to offer the reason why. But early on in my sobriety, I felt as a safety valve I needed to let people know. But that is a personal decision. Gosh, it's been such a great journey of being sober. The other thing that I have that I didn't have in my first sobriety is I have a real close group of women that I pick up the phone and I talk to. And I think that for me, kind of like the third leg of the stool, you know, I had the steps and I had the meetings, but I didn't have the fellowship. And that keeps me rock steady. I have women. I'm real shy, and it's taken me a long time to reach out. I had, you know, it was like my sponsor was the only person I reached out to for the longest time. But I always have loved all the women in my women's meetings. But I just was really scared to pick up that phone, really scared. And a couple of years ago, about 3-4 years ago, I started picking it up finally. And I have people in my life today who I know, no matter what happens, I can call on, and they will, you know, offer me their experience, strength, and hope. The other thing that I have that I did not realize I had is I have women who call on me. Very dear friend had something very dramatic happen in her family life, and I was the first person she called. And she brought that to my attention recently. She's like, you realize you were the first person I called, and I was absolutely floored. Because when I first got sober, I wouldn't have called me. Not have called me. But that was very humbling. That was very, very humbling to feel like, you know, apparently I've gotten something out of this program that somebody would feel like I had something to offer. that they would be, that I would be somebody that they called. It's very humbling. So this journey that we're on, it's so amazing, you know. All the stuff, and I was trying to think, like, since I've been sober, what all, you know, has happened, and what all have I gone through. I was really unemployable when I first got sober. My hands would shake so bad I couldn't write my name. I was on disability for a year, and when I started to feel like maybe I could work again, I worked really closely with my sponsor to define what would be an appropriate situation for me to work in and what would be appropriate hours. I was very, very careful because I was very, very fragile. And for me, you know, this is how my higher power works in my life. I got exactly what I needed. I got a position that was part-time, that was not too demanding, and that had flexible hours that allowed me to go to work and have some responsibility but not too much. You know, it was almost like this job had been perfectly designed for me, and that was such a gift. So I started to get these little gifts, and I started to trust, and I started to learn that if I talked with my sponsor, if I prayed, if I asked what God's will was for me, it would be revealed to me, and that my God has a plan for me. And I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is on a daily basis. I find out little by little. And Tara always tells to me, well, more will be revealed. And it finally stopped, for the most part, asking when? When will I know everything that's supposed to happen? You know, all I need to know is what I need to do today. And so I start my day with a daily meditation. And God knows I do not do this program perfectly at all. Sometimes I don't even do it very well. I will read my morning meditation. And if you called me 5 minutes later and said, what was the morning meditation about? I would have no clue at all. I don't know. But I do it. And I don't know. It's working. So I do that, and I have my consistent meetings. I don't know what the recommended number of meetings a week is. I know some people say 3, some people say more, some people, you know, whatever. For me, I've done one meeting a week for a long time. This year, I started getting really uncomfortable. I started off my a year ago on my birthday, I started off in not a very good place, and I was reflecting back on what the year had held for me, and it started off with my son got arrested at 15 for stupid teenage crap, and it spun me, you know. It really, really, really spun me for a loop. You know, he got arrested for trespassing is what they charged him with, was breaking and entering into a vacant building so he could ride his skateboard. And I had him, you know, in prison as the next Jeffrey Dahmer. Because that's where my head goes. So so I was reflecting back on this year, and I totally forgot what the point of that was. I had a point. More meetings. Thank you. See? So, so the point was I started getting really uncomfortable because now I knew I was raising the next Jeffrey Dahmer. So it was suggested, and I actually took the suggestion, like, maybe I should do, you know, more meetings and maybe I should work the steps again. And I started to do that, and I'm on step 8, and I haven't done my homework for a couple weeks. So I'll call you. And but I feel better, and it's been a better year. And, you know, the kid did his little juvenile diversion, whatever, you know, program he did. He was on probation for whatever you call it, I guess. Anyway, he had to be accountable to somebody for 6 months. And I started to relax into God has a plan. He has a God, and God has a plan for him. And, you know, I got to stay. I mean, I have to be, a good parent on the one hand, but that child has his own path. And eventually, if I get out of the way, it will all find out what it is and hope for the best. And I think that scared him straight, really. Because so far, he hasn't gotten arrested again. You know, the year ended for me in a kind of a funny way with me working on my steps and really finding out on a deeper level, even though I had been through the fourth and the fifth, like you were alluding to earlier, I had been through those steps before. You know, you get deeper and deeper into it. I thought I was not angry at certain people anymore. I had already gone and done and made amends, and I found out I still had a little bit of anger and stuff to work on. So I'll be moving into my eighth and ninth. Anyway, you know, it's all good. My life today is so different. I wake up in a much better mood. I don't shake. I can write my name. I have a job. My family is still together. You know, life is good. And I have a knowledge of a power greater than myself that everything's going to be okay. I have a saying that I use. And it's funny that I went to a meeting Friday night, and the meeting was on those little sayings, like easy does it and keep it simple and all that stuff. And my own little saying is, it'll work out or it won't. I don't know. But it'll work out or it won't. And if it doesn't, or if it does, I don't have to drink over it. It's the bottom line. I'm not going to die from feelings. And how things work out is none of my business as long as I don't drink over it. You know? So I don't know what the future holds. But more will be revealed. I want to close with one part in the book, and I cheated. I listened to a speaker tape on the way over here, and she ended the meeting with this, and I thought, I'm going to copy that. You know, we learn from others. Whatever. So, yeah. But I thought it was cool, so I'm going to end with this. And it's in the book, and I thought this was cute. She said it, and I'm going to say it. This is in the book. If you don't know where it is, read it until you find it. Thought it was pretty clever. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.